everybody. Welcome to Mental Illness Life. I am Brooke, and this is the one. This is the one that I probably have been dreading the most, but I think it's going to be the most shocking and controversial and all of those things, but it's also going to be kind of exciting and maybe a different way of looking at things. And I really hope, my honest hope is that by talking about this and getting this out there, it's going to spark conversation. And, you know, maybe you don't agree with it, maybe you do, maybe like this is so, you know, wild to you, but just give it a listen, give it a chance, understand it. And if you have questions or if you, you know, disagree or, you know, whatever the case may be, I'm happy to have that conversation. Again, look up facebook.com/mentalillnesslife, and I'm really trying to build a community there of like-minded people and people who just have questions or just want to feel like comfortable talking up about what they're dealing with. And in that point, you can direct message me. There's a fundraiser there as well to help with this, but I've been asked to go talk to some schools about living with mental illness. Can't do that if I have to work on my business as well, so got to pay the bills. It's all, you know, voluntary. Obviously, you can listen for free, so we're going to get started. So today, we are going to talk about drugs, specifically ecstasy. I'm going to get into a little bit of, you know, other things that are being studied right now, and then, of course, the medications that I take now to help with the mental illness and dealing with that. So I've got to start back at the beginning. And I've talked a little bit about my childhood and the trauma that happened. And again, things like this may happen to a lot of people. And it's just based on what can happen to you and how you deal with it and how you react and all of that. So when I was growing up, for me, my childhood was traumatic, and it was, the trauma was deafening. It's like the only way I can describe it. When my mother found Jesus, she found Jesus. I remember I just was not having it. I think I was like 7 or 8, and it just got increasingly more fanatic as I grew older. I'm actually going to devote an entire episode on religion and how it causes and exacerbates mental illness. And I have quite a few friends who are chomping at the bit to talk to me about that. So we're going to do that as well. But for now, just know that there were times that, like as a kid, that I didn't sleep for weeks, literally weeks, because I would lie awake having panic attacks about the rapture. Okay. Literally laying awake, thinking at any moment I would start flying into the sky to meet the Lord. So, and a side note, I am a scientist. I am a spiritual scientist. I don't know how else to describe it. I don't believe that spirituality and religion are separate. I guess spirituality. I'm not a big fan of organized religion, and we should just get that out of the way. I don't believe that God opened a physics book to create science. It's just all one thing. So at an early age, knowing this and believing this, I could not for the life of me reconcile in my mind these discrepancies. Just none of it made sense. These giant discrepancies and the issues that came up with organized religion in my world. Anyway, being told over and over and over that I was a horrible child, anything I did that wasn't serving the Lord would bring on just screaming and slapping. Like I would say hitting, but her favorite thing to do would be slap me in the face. At least once or twice a day, I would say something she didn't like and slap on the face. I think that's maybe why I don't like people touching my face. Not that like people touch my face all the time, but whatever. So that was lovely. So I feel like once I was free of it all, I branched out and I took a hold of what was there for me to discover. And this is an interesting point to make, because if you shelter your children, they will find a way to discover all the things you tried to keep from them. I guarantee it. And they won't know how to discover them in the right way. I just went full force into this. And so what happened was, I think I was about 17, it was 1993, and I remember like it was yesterday, like it was today, that a friend of mine from high school, obviously, had found out about these things called raves. And you got to remember, in 1993 on the south side of Chicago, it wasn't necessarily, like, no one really knew about this stuff. It was pretty new. I mean, it wasn't like brand new, but it was pretty new. And it hit me right away, like, this is what I want to do. I hadn't even been to one yet, but it sounded like heaven. And I'm telling you, I remember it so vividly. The one that we went to, my very first rave, was called Acid Rain. I shit you not. And I have a picture of that night, actually. I was wearing, I'm not kidding you, I was wearing a crop top. Well, I think I probably cut it off. It was a white t-shirt with the Coca-Cola logo. I don't know why. And this orange and white skirt with black combat boots. I thought I was so cool. So we go to this rave. So where I went to high school was about an hour, maybe a little less, north of Chicago. We were in the suburbs. And so it was everything that you've seen in movies and more. Like, we go down to the record store, and that was the map point. I'm not kidding you. You'd go in, you'd pay for your ticket. They would give you a map on a sheet of paper, like some little like construction paper that somebody has either drawn a map and like made copies of. And then you follow that map to some empty warehouse or something that somebody found probably 2 hours prior, that was empty, and they just kind of take it over. So I think at some point rave promoters were, you know, contacting landlords of these buildings. So, I mean, it was legit. It wasn't legit. Who knows? I don't care. And so this night, the very first rave, it was in like this old hollowed out Target that, you know, had been abandoned. And God, I remember walking in and it just smelled dank, like sweat and like mildew and moisture. And it was glorious. And there was like three different rooms with different music playing, you know, the whole DJ setup that you see in the movies, that was it. And the stacks of speakers. And I remember so clearly standing on a box. If you've ever seen like, or been to a club or, you know, been to a rave, they have these sort of like wooden boxes in the middle that you can stand on and dance. Who knows why, if you really think about it, but that's what they were. And I remember standing on that, and the, you know, the laser show was coming at me, and it was sort of like these laser lights coming around my head, and, you know, going to the beat of the music. And of course it's all electronic music, and somebody gave me a hit of acid, and I don't remember it being all that strong, but I do remember feeling sort of closer to the world. It's a difficult thing to explain. I'm sure there's people out there that can explain it way better than me, but all I know is that I felt like I'd come home. It was as if I had always been a part of that, and it just drew me home. So this rave, that's really like all I remember, was taking a hit of acid, dancing my face off, and standing on this box and having these like laser lights coming at me, and thinking to myself, this is it. This is what's gonna save me. And from then on, I was a raver and proud of it. And I mean, I was all in. We were going every weekend. You know, I started wearing the baggy clothes. I cut off my hair. I was bleach blonde hair, literally. I remember getting my tongue pierced in like 95, and you guys, that was not a thing in 95. People thought I was so weird, especially my mother. But again, it was my home. It just felt like I had always been that way. And the people who were on that journey with me were just as lost and looking for these same things. So I really should say that it was raves and music and drugs that saved me. I feel like if you don't have an appreciation for electronic music, you really should. I'm not telling you to go listen to it in your car every other day, but, you know, when it's amazing to me how it has spanned my entire life. I never listened to country music. I never listened to rock. I never listened to any of that stuff because I was so sheltered as a kid. And then when I was able to break out of that and start going to these raves, that was my life. And to this day, that's all I listen to. And it's very interesting because electronic music, there's a music producer out there called BT, the letters B and T. You probably have heard music he's produced for movies. I think he did like the Blade 2 soundtrack. He's amazing though. And he talks like really super technically, so I'll see if I can describe it right. That electronic music sort of sets your brain state into something like how the indigenous peoples like beating drums and they all sort of fall into this harmonious state together. When I was first experiencing all of this, it was mid-90s, and it was all about Chicago house music and this type of like harmonious state of togetherness that we all grew to, you know, to know. It's indescribable, but I'm going to play something for you right now, and I want you to tell me if this doesn't make you smile, because that would be just wild to me. So that is the kind of thing that I would be up against a wall of speakers dancing to for hours and hours and hours. And I am telling you, it saved my life. Because at that time, I was so lost. And all I wanted was some peace and quiet in my brain. And you know what I found is that loud, melodic, trancey music put me into a state of clarity. It's the only way I can describe it. And the movement I made with my body was so, you know, synchronous with the music, and it just like enveloped you. And this was without any drugs. But I will tell you, and again, I believe that it had immense healing effects even without the drugs. But I'm going to tell you about my experience with MDMA. Back then, we called it ecstasy, called it E. Today, I think the kids are calling it Molly. Not real sure, but I'm sure you've all heard of this. And I'm sure like you've seen a movie with somebody taking ecstasy. I remember, I think the first time that I took it, was at a party. So back then we didn't call them raves. We called them parties. A lot of times it was a Southside party. And it was as if everything up until that point was just nothing. Up until that point, all of those things just melted away. And all I was left with was pure healing bliss. It was as if just my whole life opened up to me. And I felt like I was the luckiest person in the world to be able to feel that good. And I don't know how else to describe it to people, because I have no regrets about it. I loved every minute of that. And it went on for years and years and years. I even went to college. I did very well in college, continued to do these things, and I will never regret it. It 100% saved my life, because I feel like the trauma just melted away in these times where I would be high with friends and listening to the music and doing all of these things, just created this healing in my mind. So what they're saying in these new studies that I'm going to talk to you about in just a minute is that, because they're testing these theories that MDMA and therapy can heal mental illness. Well, they say that the MDMA alone and the therapy alone aren't as effective. The MDMA seems to act as a catalyst that allows the healing to happen. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because it seemed like when I was young and lost and sad and traumatized, the use of ecstasy like brought me to a new level of hope and clarity, to where I could work on my healing. I was so aware of myself all of a sudden, and I had never had that before. It is so ironic that my mother's treatment of me was based on her fanaticism from her religious beliefs, but that I found my religion in raves and street drugs. Think about that. So I could get into, you know, all of the negative things that happened, and, you know, different situations that, you know, maybe weren't as ideal, but that's in any situation. I can tell you that I've been in way more dangerous situations being drunk, which, by the way, I quit drinking a while ago, because the things that would happen to me after being drunk all night and then coming back and like throwing up and doing all that, and you guys know what I'm talking about. You've had those nights, maybe a ton of those nights, where you're just so drunk and you don't know what you're doing, probably drove and threw up all night. I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, all of the times that I was doing ecstasy, someone was either driving me, or, you know, I slept like a baby and no after effects. There's no, you know, throwing up. Of course there's, you come down from something, but it's certainly not as bad as an alcohol hangover. I can tell you that for 100% certain. So I'm going to have you listen to this philosopher, my favorite philosopher, Jason Silva. And he's going to talk a little bit about curing PTSD. He's got a great approach. So have a listen.
So we all know that an experience of trauma can cause post-traumatic stress disorder. It can be an experience that marks and fundamentally transforms the character of a person. It can make them meet the world with fear. So my question is the opposite also true? Can an experience of such radiance, of such grace, of such astonishment and beauty be akin to a kind of inverse PTSD, and can be as fundamentally transformative to the character structure of a person that it now shifts their lenses of perception to lenses that meet the world not with fear, but instead with curiosity? Right? We all have these lenses of perception. We see with our lenses, we see through the lenses, but we don't see the lenses themselves, right? This self-construct, this lens of perception, this ego, is something that we mistake for what we are. It's not a fixed, unchanging thing. In fact, it's an amalgamation of past experiences, right? You become your experiences. Your cells are a technology that turns experience into biology. So essentially, eventually, you meet the world through a prism of expectations shaped by past trauma, past experiences, until eventually that lens is clouding your encounter with the world so much it's akin to a kind of tunnel vision. You don't see the world as it is, you see the world as you are. And what if that filter on the world is not serving you? What if seeing the world as you are is a dark fucking lens? What if you don't like who you are? Can you change who you are? Well, it turns out that ego-dissolving experiences can make the possessor of a lens of perception become aware that he has a lens of perception and dispose of that lens of perception if it no longer serves them. We need encounters with the numinous, experiences that recontextualize the self, so that you identify not with the small self, but with the self with a capital S. You stop tuning into the broadcast of the ego and you tune into the broadcast of the whole. And when you find another place to plant your feet, my friends, when you meet the world from a different vantage point, you see that you no longer are tethered to that old monkey suit and that old monkey mind. And it is through these moments of grace, right, that you remember what you forgot, right? You fundamentally transformed your self system. And perhaps now can meet the world not with fear, but instead with curiosity. You have been absolved.
Okay, now. Listen, I am not advocating for you or anyone else to go use illegal drugs. That would be stupid. And I'm also not saying that I'm regularly using MDMA to treat my post-traumatic stress disorder. But if it were legal, you are damn straight, I'd be all over that. So I want to tell you about this study that I recently read about. So this one came out of WebMD. They're talking about these MDMA studies. The long-banned club drug MDMA showed strong results as a treatment against post-traumatic stress disorder in its largest and longest study to date. The phase 2 clinical trial followed 28 patients with chronic PTSD, including military veterans and crime victims, who took the drug during 3-day-long psychotherapy sessions over 3 months. After 2 sessions, 43% of the group that received active doses of MDMA no longer met the definition of PTSD, compared to 33% who got a low dose of the drug as a placebo. And a year after the first session, 76% of the active dose group no longer had PTSD. These are according to results published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology. The long-term results are better than those seen in previous MDMA studies. That efficacy actually increases as the more time passes. Is absolutely remarkable, especially when compared to traditional treatments where people have to take drugs for months or years or for the rest of their lives to see any benefit at all. Doctors diagnose post-traumatic stress disorder in people who've experienced a life-threatening event by looking at a battery of symptoms, including nightmares, flashbacks, or feelings of depression. These new results don't mean that all the problems associated with participants' PTSD have gone away, but they don't qualify for a diagnosis of PTSD anymore. So here's some history. MDMA is the active ingredient in what's commonly known as ecstasy or Molly. It was invented in 1912 as a way to help produce drugs that controlled bleeding. But starting in the 1970s, psychiatrists found it enhanced communication with patients. By the mid-1980s, it was becoming widely abused, and the U.S. government banned it in 1985. The latest MDMA study conducted at a private clinic in Boulder, Colorado, produced no serious adverse events related to the drug. MDMA can cause the heart to race and blood pressure to jump, but the researchers report that the participants handled the drug well. They have been giving MDMA and other hallucinogenic drugs a second look for a variety of hard-to-treat mental health issues in recent years. The shift in thinking is significant, as not only did the federal government classify these drugs as having no acceptable medical uses and a high potential for abuse, but many researchers believe that they were too powerful to use therapeutically. But many officials and researchers now believe the mental health field is facing a moment of great need that's prompted some rethinking. The FDA last week granted breakthrough therapy status to another long-banned drug, psilocybin, the active ingredient in psychedelic mushrooms, as a potential therapy for treatment-resistant depression. A company called Compass Pathways, which is a U.S.-UK consortium behind the psilocybin research, says it plans to conduct the first large-scale psilocybin therapy trial over the next year. The breakthrough therapy designation is a strong endorsement for the potential of psilocybin therapy. They look forward to learning more as further clinical studies are carried out. Breakthrough designation is granted to drugs that show substantial improvement in clinical studies over existing treatments for serious conditions such as depression. Earlier research led by Johns Hopkins University concluded that psilocybin showed promise in fighting anxiety and depression in patients with life-threatening cancer, raising the prospect that it could help relieve those conditions where conventional antidepressants have had little effect. For the second time in a year, the FDA determining that a psychedelic-assisted therapy could be a significant advance over what's currently available for mental health treatment, which is very different from the last 40 years of regulatory, political, and cultural attitudes around these drugs. Regulators named MDMA a breakthrough therapy in 2017, which could put it on the fast track to approval if an upcoming phase 3 trial produces positive results. It's been decades since psychiatry has had a new set of tools available to it, and here we have psychedelics entering as a whole new class of pharmaceuticals that, when used in combination with psychotherapy, could actually be better than conventional treatments. So there you have it. When I talk about in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s, that ecstasy and acid and mushrooms saved my life, I believe that I created the right medication and therapy for myself by allowing and by discovering all of that for myself. It doesn't mean that obviously it didn't cure me of PTSD because I still have it and I have bipolar and anxiety disorder. So I wanted to tell you sort of briefly about the medications that I take now. The biggest one that probably catches your attention is lithium. And I really feel like they need to change the names of these friggin' drugs because lithium, people are like, isn't that what's in batteries? Well, yeah, we're like a big chemical soup, you know, like everything's chemicals. I take lithium. The definition is it is one of the most widely used and studied medications for treating bipolar disorder. Lithium helps reduce the severity and frequency of mania, and it may help relieve or prevent bipolar depression. That's a key here, okay? Bipolar depression is different from clinical depression, or I guess basic depression. It's sort of a coming down from a manic episode. So it's just a different state of mind. And that's why antidepressants do not work for bipolar disorder, because bipolar depression is different in that way, where it's like a coming down from this mania, whereas clinical depression, you're kind of starting there and sort of sinking. I liken it to like sinking into a bed, you know, mattress where you just cannot get out. Whereas bipolar depression is really more of a, like, you're just sad, like, and it's intense for like a little bit, and then you kind of, you know, it goes away, I guess. The drug that first saved me when I knew something was wrong, and I went to that doctor and kind of spilled it all, and I was taking the wrong medication up until that point, is a drug called lamotrigine or Lamictal. And this is an interesting medication because it's in a class called anticonvulsants, and it works by decreasing abnormal like electrical activity in the brain. So interesting, because like, how do they know what's abnormal electric activity? But they do. And it's actually used to treat certain types of seizures in patients who have epilepsy. And so the way that they look at it as well is that it's used to increase the time between episodes of depression, mania, and other abnormal moods in patients with bipolar disorder. So again, it's that increasing the time between the episodes. This is not a cure. None of this is a cure. It just balances out the distance and the time between when all this shit happens to you and when it comes on. I've taken other things in the past, you know, sort of added to this, but those are the two main drugs. And, you know, they're pretty potent. I can usually always feel a difference if I don't take the Lamotrigine in the morning. I can feel the effects of not having it in my system. So even after 10 years, people ask a lot, like, so you have to take that forever? Yep, got to take it forever. And I'm happy to do it. I also, every once in a while, I'll take Xanax. That is a difficult drug to prescribe to someone who used to do drugs. And I should touch on the fact that I don't believe that I was addicted to drugs. I do believe that I had a tendency to throw caution to the wind and do what I wanted, but I don't really, there were definitely times, and I'm going to talk about this another time, there were other drugs and there was lines crossed, no pun intended, but a lot of cocaine, a lot of ketamine, a lot of stuff that I really should not have done. And I think, you know, those were the mistakes that I made, but I'll never say that taking ecstasy was a mistake or some sort of addiction. So listen, what I want you to get out of this is just maybe a better appreciation for those of us who made those decisions and then came out okay in the end, you know? Like, we still struggle, but I feel like so many times we hear about drug users that end up dead and, or, you know, just not well. And I'm not going to say that I'm, you know, this hugely successful person. You know, I have had success in my life and I've had successful relationships and I am a successful parent and I'm a successful co-parent. And I'm a functioning member of society as best I can. And yet, I had a string of probably 10 years where I was high on drugs 90% of the time. I also went to college during that time. I also did, you know, held jobs during that time. So I think you probably just aren't going to hear much about those of us that did that. I think because we've all just forgotten about it. But now these things are coming up and these studies are being done. And I feel like you're going to see a lot less stigma when it comes to pharmacology and how we help the mental illness going forward, the mental health, you know, issues going forward. So thank you so much for listening. And I hope that you'll head over to Mental Illness Life on Facebook and leave some comments. Leave a comment on iTunes if that's where you're listening, or Spotify or Anchor. But reach out to me. You know, if you don't know what to do right now and you're feeling these ways that, you know, maybe I've explained about bipolar, I've explained about PTSD or depression or any of those things, and you are thinking to yourself, that's me. You know, I really urge you to reach out. There are so many resources. I know that if there's resources in Boise, Idaho, where I'm at, I know there's resources where you are. And reaching out, figuring out where you can go to even just talk to someone about it. You know, maybe there's a place that has a sliding scale. I know a lot of people deal with insurance issues or they just don't know where to go. Really reach out and check in your community. I'm going to try to put some resources up as best I can to kind of find where you can go in your specific area. But I know if you just do a little digging, go to the Googles, and you'll be able to find at least something. If you can't, please reach out to me, and I will be happy to help. Otherwise, I hope that you have a wonderful day. I love you dearly, and thank you for listening.